You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow, another ton, or lift another finger till the union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in our hearts and fire in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole.
This is the Labor Exchange on KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild, Local 37074. Our guest today is Joel Buchanan, retired member of United Steelworkers 2102 in Pueblo, Colorado. Welcome to the Labor Exchange, Joel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to invite you on the show because we had a Zach Workowicz with the El Pueblo Museum on a couple months ago, and he talked about an exhibit there at the El Pueblo Museum called Steel City 1980 to 2004. I know that was, you were involved with a lot of that in that time frame, but we always like to start off the show by getting to know our guests a little more. So, just tell us a bit more about your personal story, maybe what brought you to Pueblo and working at the mill.
Well, actually, I lived in Pueblo for most of my life. I moved here when I was about 12 years old from San Antonio, Texas. My dad was an oil worker, actually, and so we traveled around some. I was actually born in Cody, Wyoming, and then spent time in my youth in Barranquilla, Colombia, and then San Antonio, and then we finally ended up in Pueblo. I started to work at the steel mill in 1970 in a department that's long been shut down. It was the ore preparation. I've now been retired since 2013, and I manage or run the Steelworkers Organization of Active Retirees for Steelworker District 12, which is the 11 Western states. And I'm also involved with the AFL-CIO and the Southern Colorado Labor Council down here.
Okay, great. So in the ore prep department, what was that like, and what were you doing at the mill?
Well, the ore prep is where they would bring in the iron ore and prep it for the blast furnace. So when I started, I was a laborer shoveling iron ore all day. It was a real dirty job. The iron ore from Wyoming is red, so we all had a red tint to us. And so did the neighborhood around that end of the steel mill. But I ended up going into an apprenticeship and becoming a millwright, which later evolved because of the combination of jobs into a maintenance mechanic technician. And then in my later years, the last couple of years that I worked there, I took a production job as running a sizing mill in the tube mill.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering too, I couldn't remember, did you ever do were they like coke batteries, the kind of big?
Yep.
Yeah.
I worked in it went in those days when there was a slowdown and maybe in the ore prep, we would get transferred over to another department. And so I worked in the coke plant for a while. I also worked in the blast furnace. And then after our strike, I ended up working in steel production on the electric furnace as a furnace millwright. I spent 7 or 8 years in the power department along that journey. So I have a lot of experience all over the steel mill, I guess.
Yeah. And the reason I mentioned the coke batteries is just that I think when you look at architecturally some of the old like coke ovens around in some of the towns that produced steel, that's where they took coal and purified it. And so it's the kind of next step or the industrialized form of that, where they're these big metal, batteries is the best way to describe it, just a big kind of almost locker full of really hot coal. So it's always been kind of one of those pictures you see that's pretty striking at the mill. But you mentioned the strike. Would you be able to give us kind of a summary or a just give me some background for someone who wasn't aware of it? This is when Colorado Fuel and Iron was purchased by Oregon Steel. Is that, am I getting the time frames right?
Yes. So in 1992, Oregon Steel came in and bought the steel mill. The steel mill at that time, CF&I Steel, was because of technology and also because of imported steel. The steel mill was in pretty much financial straits and had just filed a bankruptcy. Oregon Steel came in and bought it at a discount price and did invest some money into it and took over the management of the mill. They had an initial contract because we had successorship, so they had to adopt our current union contract, and then we negotiated a new contract, which was in the end, I think it was the September of 92, somewhere in that area, or October of 92 maybe, and then that was a five-year contract. So during the 5 years up to 1997, Oregon Steel just really had a commitment, I think, to break the union. They started out as pretty good managers for the first year, and then things just kind of went downhill from there as far as employee treatment, excessive overtime hours, cutting back on safety procedures, and it just got worse and worse. So when we went into contract negotiations in 1997, which October 3rd, 1997, we struck. It really was not about the money. It was just about the treatment and the excessive overtime hours and the lack of safety. And I guess the main part of it really was the forced overtime, because people were working 60 to 80 hours a week. I know I worked a lot of weeks straight without any days off. And if you called off for any kind of a family function or had a graduation that your son or daughter graduated, you weren't allowed to take that time off and was counted against you. So that caused the strike. For me personally, at the time, I had just, the middle of September, I had a severe injury out there to my hand, and it was, my hand was crushed and the tip of my finger was amputated. So when the strike come, I was pretty incapacitated. So it was a real stressful time for me.
Yeah. You had just gotten injured, and then this was going on. If you don't mind, if it's not, you know, too much, would you be able to describe the accident that caused you to be injured?
So on an arc furnace, they melt steel. Then they, once the steel's melted, it's the furnace itself kind of acts like a teapot is the best way. So it tilts, and there's a, they call it a spout on the side of it that the hot steel runs and goes into a ladle, train car ladle for the hot steel. Anyway, we were changing that spout called a runner. And it's excessively, I don't have any idea what the weight is, but tons, because of it builds up, the steel builds up on it as it runs through, and then eventually it has to be changed out. And it's held by an overhead crane. Well, we take the bolts off of the side to unhook it from the furnace. So I was taking these bolts off, nuts off, and the crane was just a little bit on the wrong angle. So when the bolts or the nuts came loose or got looser, the whole thing swung and broke the bolts, and it swung and caught my hand between the weight and a handrail, actually. And that's how my hand got crushed.
Yeah, I've talked to steelworkers and heard some of the interviews that went into the El Pueblo Museum's exhibit. There are these sort of close calls. I did want to pull on the forced overtime or the quality of life issues, because we still see those today. Sort of the top issues in the railroad unions that are, seeking to get a good agreement right now with the major carriers. Having that time with family and the ability to take time off is sort of paramount to having a good life. I wanted to ask, so one of the things though with the strike, I know that you eventually started working as what I think was called the Road Warriors. Can you talk a little bit about that? What was that about? And what were the sort of duties that folks like you took on during that time?
Well, I was asked this. So we went on strike on October 3rd. Then in the end of December, the union made an offer to go back to work. That was a legal strategy, forcing the company to either take us back or carry on. And what had happened is when we went on strike, the company had already been advertising around the country for scab labor. So people were being brought into town weeks before the actual deadline of the contract. And they were housed here in town out in Pueblo West, which is just west of town a little bit. Guess you could call it a little suburb or whatever. But so the morning we went on strike, they were ready to go, and they just caravaned them right into the mill. So what happened is that kind of changed the strike into a lockout, because the company made a statement that they already were fully staffed and they would just take back. It's a whole legal thing without going in all the details, but they had to take back under their, they considered it a economic strike. The union considered it a unfair labor practice strike. So under the guidelines of a economic strike, when an opening became available, like one of the scabs left, that job would have to be filled by a union worker. Of course, the union looked at it as a unfair labor strike, which meant if it was declared that they, all the scabs would have to leave and the union people would come right back in. And that's what got caught up in court, and they fought it for the next 6 years before we got settled. My involvement became, how I got involved as a road warrior, the steelworkers come up with a strategy to go after Wells Fargo Bank, who was carrying the credit card and supplying the money to keep the company running. So we launched a national boycott. They developed what they call an outreach program, and they selected a few of us workers and people that were pretty much activists in the union to go out to different parts of the country, and where steelworker local unions had accounts with Wells Fargo. And our job was to go out and ask those people to obviously to close their accounts with Wells Fargo. There was five, I think we started out with five of us, and my first assignment was to go to Houston, Texas. And then they had people in Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, I believe, in Portland. And the idea was to go meet with steelworker locals or other locals that we could identify that had accounts with Wells Fargo and ask them to close their accounts. It was a pretty, at the time for me, I mean, I'm just a steelworker in Pueblo, Colorado. I don't know anything about banking, and I was not sure how boycotts work. So I was a little leery about it, but I went down to Houston and they paired us up with a couple of couple of steel workers down there, and then we visited the local unions, and it turned out not only steel worker unions, but I know we went to a letter carriers local, did a presentation there, and the boycott just ended up blooming. I mean, it became a pretty major thing, especially on the West Coast. So
Yeah, that's the steelworkers, I think, are really well known for these types of corporate campaigns, or they're called comprehensive campaigns, where you look at the employer and see, what leverage points might be there to, influence and try to make things better at the mill. And one of the ways is, okay, we have people that maybe have a reason to support us that could potentially, put pressure on them by leaving Wells Fargo and saying, this is why we're leaving. There's a couple of books that have been written about that. There's Ravenswood, The Steelworkers' Victory and Revival of American Labor by Kate Broffenbrenner. And then you actually turned me on to one, Death of a Thousand Cuts, which is really about the same thing, but written maybe from the other side. And my copy, I just to let you know, Joel, when I ordered it, came with a memo from a defunct snack food company saying, hey, read this. This might be why we're getting a lot of press about our suppliers in the global South and South America. So I just thought that was pretty funny. That Death of a Thousand Cuts book came with highlighted corporate memo. I'm not going to say it because I don't know if I get sued or not, even though like someone probably owns the brand, but yeah, it was a snack cake company.
If you read in there, hold on just a second. Is this the book?
Yep, that's the one. Yep, that's it.
So there's a whole section, not a section, but there's a part of it that talks exactly about our strike and some of the stuff that I was involved in personally in there, some of the tactics that we used. I ended up working in Portland, Oregon, which was the headquarters for the company. And that's where I was in San Francisco for a while and then up in Portland. And then we, worked against the corporation on the front lines, I like to say.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you saw with the community coming together to support striking steelworkers, or any sort of memories you might have of that.
Well, I assume you're talking about our community here.
Yeah.
Ended up getting a lot of support from Portland community in the long run also, because of some other stuff that we did up there to bring recognition. But here in Pueblo, they absolutely got behind. You have to remember this plant. Well, this year it's 150 years old. So for generations, that steel mill was the main employer, and could almost say that the town was built around the steel mill. So when we had that strike, which actually was really the first strike in memory, they had a national strike in 1959. Where all the steel mills went out at one time and for about 3 weeks, I think. But as far as a one-on-one strike at the steel mill here, was the first one. So a lot of people didn't know exactly what was going to happen. But one of the things we did is go around and try and get support from the businesses. We had these little signs made up, and we'd ask them to put them in their window saying, "I support Pueblo Steelworkers." The support then it became a whole movement to support the mill. And we had all these replacement workers or scabs brought in from other towns. And I can tell you incident after incident. One that comes to my mind right now is these guys would go over to a Safeway store. The replacement workers were to cash their paychecks. The UFCW people there, Pueblo people, wouldn't cash their paychecks. Management got involved and told them they had to or they'd lose their job. I actually know of two people that did lose their job because of that. But what happened to the Safeway store employees said, okay, but we're going to go by the guidelines of cash and checks. So when somebody would come in to cash one of those checks, they'd say they had to provide proof of employment. At the time, they were told not to tell anybody where they worked. So we were able to, they were able to stop cashing checks for a while. But another incident I remember that was really touched me the most of all the community involvement is for the first few weeks of the strike, all the scabs would meet. And the way the mill set up, they had to drive down a residential street and then go into the steel mill. And there's a restaurant that they had, a little restaurant, old restaurant, were frequented by steel workers for years. And it before prior to it being a restaurant, it was a little grocery store. When I started, it was a little grocery store. Go in there and get your lunch made, going to work. So what would happen is when they would caravan at shift change down the street, the restaurant, all the people in the restaurant would, they'd stop serving, they'd go out in the, on the sidewalk and yell at the scabs and throw tin cans. And then people in the neighborhood would come out of their houses with signs and throw paper and stuff at them, scabs. And just to see that was, it kind of makes me emotional right now because it was just really an amazing support. Businesses around would help with food, and we started a food bank. That we had a doctor that volunteered to come down two or three times a week to the union hall, and you know, if people had little issues, it'd help with that. There was clothing donations, and it was just really amazing the support we got from the community.
Well, and I think that supports one of the things that helps sustain within that. And that's one of those key lessons in the book on Ravenswood, which is about the steelworkers' comprehensive campaigns. And some of the things I've heard about it is just that you needed to have that, build community support, but some of it sounds like it was, you know, there because this is just, it was just integrated. It was part of what folks knew about their neighbors. I think, you know, we didn't talk about it too much at the beginning, but when you were talking about the folks having to go back in the mill, that's one of the stories that I think is hard for people to understand too, is with the complex legal background of this case, there were times where folks who were union had to get right back in the mill. Other people stayed out the entire time. And so just pretty, not confusing, but necessarily, but just complicated. And that's still a complicated history. And so that's why I liked the El Pueblo Museum really taking this on and trying to find a way to interpret this history and share it back with the community. When you went to the El Pueblo Museum exhibit, to the opening and to some of the other events, what was that like?
Well, Zach Werwich, they had set up they called a round table where some of the strikers from that period would come in and just basically sit around the table and tell their stories, and they recorded that. And so when I went in, so I was a little bit involved with helping with that, some of that. But when you see it again, and the news, they had, or they still do, of course, have the exhibit of some of the newspapers at the time up, and you can read what happened, and it just really brings back a lot of memories. Some good, or most good, actually, in the long run, some not so good. I mean, for me, I spent 3 years out on the road as a road warrior. I spent about a little over two and a half years in Portland, away from my family. And at the time, I had three sons that were one had just graduated from high school, and two were in high school, I believe, or middle school. But, that was kind of rough. I brought them out to Portland, and they got on the picket lines, and they got to learn a lot. But it was still rough being away. I missed a portion of their lives being up there. And so going back to the museum and seeing the exhibits, and what really got me most actually was the newspaper clippings, because I hadn't read some of those in years and years and years, and it kind of refreshed your memory, you know. I have to say, those 3 years, I was one of the people that ended up having to go back to work with the scabs, which was probably the roughest part of the whole thing. I'd spent 3 years fighting these people, and then all of a sudden I'm stuck right in there with them. So when I went back to work, the very first day, within the first 2 weeks, they were really messing with me, moving me from one job to the next, one day here, one day there. Finally, they put me on a straight graveyard shift with this particular scab, me and him working together. And that was really hard. And I think it actually contributed to this day, I think, some PTSD I had, you know, for a while. So that was one of the roughest parts of the whole thing, was going back to work. But overall experience, it changed my life. I can honestly say I've met people that to this day that are still close friends. Like I say, I have a real close friend up in Spokane, Washington. We talk almost daily.
Thank you so much for being on the Labor Exchange today and sharing some of your stories.
Well, thank you for having me, Robert. Thank you for your involvement also.
This has been the Labor Exchange on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild. Our guest today is Joel Buchanan, retired steel worker, involved in the strike with Oregon Steel in the 90s, and the subject of an exhibit at the El Pueblo Museum.
Listeners, we're going to end the show by playing the song Heidi Ho from Solidarity Rocks, a CD put out by the United Steelworkers during this era. It was written by the District 12 Women of Steel and sung by United Steelworker members Fran Garman, Janet Royston, Deborah Lawson, and Kathy Kluzinski. I hope you enjoy.
Heidi, Heidi, Heidi Ho. Heidi, Heidi, Heidi Ho. Heidi, Heidi, Heidi Ho. Heidi, 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 hey. Heidi, 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 ho. Heidi, 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 hey.
See the sisters dressed in gold.
They're sweet, but they're bold.
See the sisters dressed in blue.